It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, as they are every week, or darn near every week, John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you both?
Great.
I'm fine.
All right.
Maria's over there looking over her glasses, but...
Don't leak my dirty secret, Jeff.
Which ones?
Oh, now you've opened it up. No. We were having a discussion about eyeglasses before the microphones went live. Anyway,
right.
We're doing well.
Very good. Well, the local media was having a...
In full pucker mode.
As they generally are.
Yeah.
Talking about Boeing and Phil Condit saying bye-bye.
Well, yes, and wasn't it a remarkable scoop that the Seattle Times managed to have a front-page story on the location of where the 787 might be the day after all this happened? Like, we can't hurry to sweep this off the front page quickly enough, can we? It was a very bad week for Boeing, and not only that, but it's going to continue to be a bad week for Boeing every week for, well, the foreseeable future, just because their high-ranking executives up to and including Mr. Condon are dropping like flies does not mean that we have heard the end of this, although you might have to go to other newspapers in other cities to find out the full story.
Yeah, I recommend the Chicago Tribune.
Yeah, without going into too much detail just yet as to what all the various ethical violations have been, because as they are alleged anyway, there have been quite a few. But it really has been very striking for the past month, that first of all of these various ethical violations and the resignation first of a couple of higher-ranking executives before Thanksgiving, and then when that didn't do the trick on Wall Street of Mr. Condit himself and in Congress, much of this was brought to light by the persistence of two Republican hawk senators, John McCain of Arizona and Peter Fitzgerald of Illinois. Now, mind you, I said Illinois. That is the home state where Boeing has moved its corporate headquarters. But because the city of Chicago is a big city with a diversified economy and even beyond that, a sense of self as a city that is not dependent on any one or two institutions, you can have a senior senator that demands accountability out of a corporation who bases its home there, and you can have a newspaper, in the case of the Chicago Tribune, that is willing to spell out on the front page what the ethical violations are, which neither the Times nor the PI did.
Yeah, the PI was particularly bad. James Wallace, who's supposed to be a critic and a person who follows Boeing very closely, wrote the article in the PI, and it mentioned kind of glancingly the ethical violations, but you had to turn to the inside of the paper and read a separate article written by the PI staff to really find what the details of those ethical violations were, whereas the Chicago Tribune article on Boeing just spelled it out in the first few paragraphs exactly what the problem was and why Condit was given the boot. It was an amazing contrast.
Yeah, I was sitting Monday morning in the Seattle Weekly has its weekly news department meetings on Monday mornings, which is, you know, basically Condit resigned on Sunday evening. So this was all when all this was breaking, and we ripped up the previously scheduled cover story and went to a Boeing package, which we wrote in a rip-roaring hurry. You know, usually those are written well in advance, specifically because the coverage of the TV stations, it kind of goes without saying, but particularly the daily paper coverage of Boeing was so bad. And, you know, in the piece that I wrote for that package, one of the contrast that I made was between Fitzgerald, the senator from Illinois, and Patty Murray, who as late as last week was saying things like, well, this, you know, the tanker deal, which is what brought all of this on, was the deal for 100 tankers to be leased and bought from from Boeing by the Department of Defense. And mind you, this is a tremendous exception to usual DoD policy. Usually they buy outright. And, of course, leasing is a much more favorable gig for Boeing.
And much more expensive for taxpayers.
Yes, very much more expensive, although, you know, being more expensive for taxpayers usually doesn't figure into military appropriations. But and Boeing has tried to make a small fortune off of that. But while you know, Fitzgerald is sending letters from Congress saying that the Pentagon should delay this deal, which it eventually did this week, and that this needs to be looked at more closely, Patty Murray is whining that, well, this is already the most examined deal in history. Can't we just sign it and have it done with? And then, and when we had the executives resigning before Thanksgiving, we had her saying, "Well, particularly in regards to the woman who came over seemingly specifically for the purpose of getting the tanker deal sealed, we had Patty Murray going, "Well, I'm not a part of Boeing's employee policies." You know, it really was a startling contrast. Yeah, it really was a startling contrast between somebody who between somebody who's looking out for taxpayers and somebody who was trying to kiss up to Boeing and trying to inherit the mantle of being the senator from Boeing. And you know, those days are over. It's not 1955 anymore, and there's a big chunk of civic Seattle that needs to learn that. You know, the world's fair has come and gone. It's over. Get over it. And the same is true for how we handle Boeing in this city. And meanwhile, you know, Boeing, it really got caught with its hand, you know, trying to buy off the cookie factory as opposed to the cookie jar. But it really isn't doing anything too tremendously different from how Lockheed Martin and Raytheon and Northrop Grumman and all the rest of them are doing business as well. I mean, Boeing has done it particularly clumsily, but you know, this sort of revolving doors and the way that people are promised jobs or you know, tacitly understood to have jobs waiting for them once they put their years in at the DoD and retire. The way that money changes hands, the way that a new gold rush is happening through the military appropriations bills that are going through post 9/11. This is how many companies in the defense sector are doing business right now, and it's why there's no money left in the federal budget and why there's such a tremendous deficit. It is the reason. You know, that and tax cuts for the wealthy are going to have us bankrupt for generations to come.
All right, moving along, the discovered this week that the country of Russia and Kyoto seem to be moving farther apart, and it's just not, you know, tectonic drift. It's
partially it was bad timing because winter is setting in, and apparently our good friend Vlad the Impaler, decided that it, you know, really it'd be that bad if winters were warmer in Russia. But you know,
that's not quite how global warming works.
we understand that. But I'm not sure that when our good friend George was trying to explain it to him over the telephone, that George didn't get it wrong.
Right.
and that really is a big chunk of what happened here is that the Bush administration has been leaning very, very heavily on Russia. For really a couple of years now to try and get them not to ratify the Kyoto Accord, because the way Kyoto has been set up, it needs countries that represent a certain percentage of global emissions to ratify the treaty. And once the United States, which is by far the biggest emitter, decided not to, then Russia's signature was needed in order to make the treaty go forward. So this has been something that has been in the crosshairs of the Bush administration for some time. And, you know, really, the Kyoto Accord was originally drawn up in, 1993, I believe, or 94?
Yeah.
I think it was 94. But it's scheduled to go through 2011. So we've already gone through half of the period of time that was covered by the Kyoto Treaty with no real – I mean, there have been progress. There has been progress certainly in different locations in terms of actions that the European Union and smaller individual governments have taken to curb emissions. And,
although several of the European Union states are backsliding now.
Yes, they are. But you look at the amount of time that has been lost and the degree of irreversibility that has set in during that period of time, and you look at the fact that by this point, if Kyoto had gone forward swimmingly and everybody had ratified it, negotiations should have started almost immediately, certainly be well underway by now, for what sort of protocol would have gone into effect after Kyoto. I mean, we need to be planning for 2010, 2015, 2020 around global warming. And, you know, the first step that's going to be needed to have that take effect is to get the United States to have a change of policy. And mind you, Clinton Gore was not handling Kyoto with anything approaching good faith even before the Bush administration came in. I mean, the Bush administration has been much more straightforward about their opposition. But the United States
Gore, who helped draft the deal, he actually made it to quite a bit wimpier than it was originally proposed, and then Clinton never brought the treaty before Congress for ratification, which was a major mistake.
Yeah, and the way that it was originally supposed to be set up, as you said, it was significantly watered down by our environmentalist Al Gore. But you know, the question at this point is where we go from here. And the first place we go from here is that we have to have a change of administration, and even beyond a change of administration, whoever comes in to replace George Bush from among the Democrats will have to have, it has to treat the situation with a sense of urgency and a sense of leadership, global leadership, far more so than Clinton and Gore did. Because otherwise, you're not going to get the European Union, you're not going to get Russia, and you're certainly not going to get China and India, especially China, as they come on and industrialize, to agree to any kind of meaningful sacrifices unless other countries are doing it as well, especially the United States. We are the big impediment to getting this done.
All right, moving along. This week in Iraq, plenty of developments there.
Pa-rum-pa-pum-pum.
Job. This week in Iraq, the first item on my list, the guerrillas have expanded their targets to include U.S. allies in Iraq. Over last weekend, 7 Spanish military intelligence agents were ambushed and killed. 2 Japanese diplomats were killed in another ambush near Tikrit, and a Colombian civilian contractor was killed on the same day, and 2 of his colleagues were wounded in another ambush. And then on the next day, 2 South Korean civilian contractors who were working for a company restoring electrical transmission lines in Iraq were shot while driving in a civilian car near Tikrit. Now, there are 2 very interesting and disturbing aspects to these attacks. One is that all the victims were dressed as civilians and riding in civilian vehicles. Now, on Saturday, the day of most of these attacks, Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, who's really the head military official in Iraq, told reporters in Baghdad in a news conference that Iraqi police appear to be coordinating some of the attacks against U.S. personnel. Now, his direct quote was, "There have been instances when police were coordinating attacks against the coalition and against the people." Now, these attacks against civilian contractors, and particularly the Spanish military intelligence agents, probably fall under that category as well. And that's something that you're not hearing much about in the U.S. press. This is
They had to know who these people were first.
Right. This is also something that we warned about a couple of months ago here on this program, when the U.S. ramped up this massive recruitment drive for Iraqi policemen, and then decided to provide only minimal training, 3 weeks at best. There was a question of how much screening they could actually do of these new recruits, and it appears that they've had guerrillas join the police force, or probably in some of these cases, police quit their jobs and join the guerrillas.
Yeah, and we also talked about this when the bombing of the UN compound in Baghdad happened.
Yes.
And one of the first things that we talked about, and I believe the bombing happened, just a day or two before we came on the air here, and it really wasn't talked about in U.S. media accounts, but it was very obvious, just from the placement of the bomb at the time, that the guerrillas had to have somebody who knew when these people were meeting and where they were meeting inside the U.N. compound. It had to be an inside job.
Yeah, they placed the bomb right beneath the U.N. Sergio Vieira de Mello's office, practically.
And this is something that has, this is a pattern that has repeated itself time and time again ever since.
The missile attacks on the Al-Rashid Hotel targeted the areas of the hotel where U.S. reporters and officials were staying.
Yeah, we saw it when Wolfowitz was in Baghdad, mm-hmm. because that was something that was not publicized. You know, time and time again, clearly, guerrillas have had inside intelligence as to where U.S. and other Western officials would be and when. And at the same time, the U.S. doesn't even know who it's fighting. You know, the forces in this country don't have people over there who can speak the language, who know the history, who know the culture. They have no idea what's going on.
They do have people who speak the language, but those are former exiles who don't know the country anymore.
Yeah, but that's where I was going with that, uh-huh. was that the people that they do have are people with their own agendas, and yeah. either they don't know the country or they're pushing their own agendas and they're feeding bad information to settle their own scores or make their own fortunes rather than for the purposes that U.S. intelligence wants. So it really is a significant disadvantage for the U.S. forces over there. And it's one that's going to be very difficult to address.
Yeah. And so the second disturbing aspect of these attacks against the U.S. allies in Iraq, the Japanese, Koreans, the Spanish intelligence agents, these attacks came in a cluster in a two-day period just before Colin Powell was scheduled to meet with NATO member nations to try and get them to send troops to Iraq. Now, Powell's plea fell on deaf ears for several reasons, but the most important one is this. NATO does not have the troops and equipment to send to Iraq. Right now, NATO is in charge of the peacekeeping force in Afghanistan, which is largely confined to the capital city of Kabul, simply because they lack the helicopters.
It's all they can handle.
Yeah. They lack the helicopters, the troops, the transport aircraft, and the support personnel to move outside the capital, even though the member nations had voted to do this several months ago. So it's kind of interesting to see Bush administration officials approach NATO now, this late in the game, and with no understanding of NATO's inability to actually respond, regardless of the fact that some of the member nations already have a few troops, all the troops they can spare, in fact, in the country right now. And those that oppose the war actually have their troops deployed in other parts of the world. France has troops deployed in Africa, the same with Germany. And Germany has troops deployed in Eastern Europe as well. Now, another topic for this week in Iraq is the Governing Council. Now, the Governing Council, which was appointed by the U.S., as folks may remember, is currently being torn apart by factional infighting over three main issues. The first one is that Shiite clerics want elections to choose the representatives to sit on the new legislature, while everyone else, the Kurds, Sunnis, former exiles, secular Shiites, and of course the Bush administration, want to have caucuses instead. Now, the Shiites are a 60% majority nationwide, which is why they want elections. Shiite clerics are also very popular in the Shiite community, which is why the secular Shiites, including former exiles like Ahmed Chalabi, are against elections. Now, the Bush administration is afraid that a Shiite majority will set up a fundamentalist government allied with Iran, which would be a major disaster for long-term U.S. goals in Iraq. And this issue has deadlocked the council, and the Bush administration will have to work out some kind of compromise, and we'll see that in the next week or two, what they come up with. But it's pretty clear that Shiite clerics have put their foot down, and the U.S. is going to have to give on this issue.
And there are a number of reasons why it does not want to do so,
right.
Having those elections could just be a disaster for the U.S.
Right. Not to mention the fact that the security situation makes it hard to do right now anyway. Now, the second issue that the governing council is fighting over is the Bush administration has finally caved into pressure from the Pentagon's five favorite political parties on the governing council to set up paramilitary squads to help fight the guerrillas. Now, these death squads, which is what they are going to be, are composed of the militias which are controlled by these five political parties. And I'm going to name those parties right now. The Iraqi National Congress, which is Ahmed Chalabi's group. Iraqi National Accord, which is controlled by a guy named Ayed Alawi, who is also a former exile, like Chalabi. The two Kurdish parties, the PUK and the KDP, and the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, which is also an exile, also controlled by former exiles who are allied with Iran. Now, the other members of the council, that's 20 members of the council as opposed to the five I just mentioned, are throwing fits over this, saying, as we've said here on the air on this program, that setting up these paramilitary death squads composed of militias from five factions that do not get along will lead to civil war, factional infighting, and massive human rights abuses. And they are completely correct in this. And this issue is dividing the council very severely.
Yeah, and let's repeat that once again, since it's not likely to show up in U.S. media accounts. What this will result in is, shall we say the phrase again, death squads. It will happen.
Yes. And then the third issue that's come up before the council and is causing a lot of major problems is that the former exiles on the council have pushed for the governing council to vote on a topic that that of course the Bush administration has just totally cringed over this issue as well. The governing council, these five exile groups, want the governing council to remain in place even after a new government is either elected or selected in 2004. Now, the governing council was supposed to go completely out of existence once the new government is set up. However, that's not enough job security for these former exiles, who are not at all sure that they can dominate the caucuses in various parts of the country in order to get their cronies on a new legislature and then dominate the new legislature in the same way that they dominate the governing council. So they want the governing council to continue into existence, and they're still trying to come up with a name for it. They haven't decided whether they want to call it the Senate or the Sovereignty Council or whatever. But it's pretty comic. And in this issue in particular, the Iraqi people have just kind of thrown up their hands and said, look at these clowns, what are we doing with these guys in any kind of power positions in Iraq?
Yeah, and if it was the Americans that put these people in power positions in the first place, why should we trust the Americans who are choosing all of the participants who are going to participate in this caucus process?
Right, exactly.
So if this National Congress is what we got the first time around, how is it going to be any better this next time?
Mm-hmm. That's right. And then the final topic I want to talk about in this week in Iraq is folks might have read a little bit in the papers about the shootout in Samarra. Early this week, U.S. troops engaged guerrillas in a major firefight in the town of Samarra in Iraq. Now, the first reports were from U.S. spokespersons who said that 46 Iraqi guerrillas were killed and 11 were taken prisoner. And then after a couple of hours, the news reports changed, the numbers changed, to 54 guerrillas killed and 22 taken prisoner. Well, then the media began to ask questions. They began to question these figures and to visit the town of Samarra. They wanted to get some data to confirm these U.S. military reports. Now, and they also asked whether the U.S. could produce the dead bodies. And the military spokesman said, well, no, we don't actually have any dead bodies to show you, and that the guerrillas must have carried away all of their dead. But now, at the same time, the U.S. spokesman said that the guerrillas had only numbered between about 60 to 80 men. That's the total number of attackers. So reporters who can do math pretty quickly, I mean, they're not slouches, right? They started to add and subtract, and they realized that if 54 guerrillas had been killed and 22 taken prisoner out of 80 total, that's the high figure that was given to them by the U.S. military, that would leave only three alive to carry away 54 dead bodies.
Yes, and if 54 were killed and 22 taken prisoner from amongst 60 guerrilla attackers, then you've got
the
a real problem.
Really, yeah. Don't add up. So reporters visited the hospitals in Samarra and the morgues in search of these dead bodies. What they found were 8 to 9 dead people, most of them civilians, and more than 50 civilians wounded. When they interviewed witnesses, the witnesses said, these are Iraqi civilians who were in Samarra during the firefight, they said that U.S. troops sprayed gunfire indiscriminately in all directions, shooting, among other things, a bus full of people getting off work from a local factory, a crowded marketplace in the center of the city, and people leaving a mosque after religious services. The local Iraqis now refer to this whole incident as the Samarra Massacre. Now, given the vast disparity between these two accounts, it may be impossible to really find out what happened in Samarra. But one thing is pretty clear. There are no 54 dead guerrillas. The bodies simply can't be found. And given the facts that the U.S. Military spokesman gave out, it simply is not possible.
Yeah, and you know, once again, this is something where the military, I mean, you can call it the fog of war, you can call it an intentional disinformation campaign, but the information given to the American people was flatly wrong, and the disinformation appeared on the front page and in the lead of every evening newscast. The corrections appeared in a paragraph on page E22 of a paper 3 days later.
You have to go in search of that information.
Yeah, it really is a case where the net impact of this was to give people in this country the sense that, oh, maybe things aren't going so bad. At least we got a few of theirs also. And, of course, you know, Iraqis are being killed every day over there that we don't hear about. It's just that so many of them are civilians, so, you know, they're not bragging about it here. But it really was a case where the military impact of this firefight was negligible, except perhaps in enraging and inspiring more Iraqi civilians to join the other side. But the impact on what people in this country understand to be happening in Iraq was sizable.
Mm-hmm. And does this also tie back to your original point about that? I believe the whole reason the U.S. was had a force going into that town was because they were delivering money for a large quantity of money.
They're swapping out the old Iraqi dinars with new currency.
And I'd read an account where that it was, again, inside information that tipped some people off.
Right. There were two groups of Iraqi guerrillas waiting in ambush for the convoy that was guarding the currency going into Samarra. And I think what probably happened, this is just my surmise, is that these two guerrilla groups started firing on U.S. troops and then probably pulled back when they encountered heavy resistance, and that left U.S. troops spraying whole neighborhoods of civilians with gunfire indiscriminately and not being able to stop, just out of sheer panic.
Yeah, and one of the things that's happening frequently in these attacks is that, I mean, literally, by the time the mortars are in the air, you know, these guerrilla groups they're hopping on their motorbikes and fleeing in all directions. They're gone. By the time fire is returned, there's nothing to fire back at. Of course, you know, you wouldn't know that unless you read, I think Doonesbury has had something on it. I mean, it just is not featuring in media accounts in this country, but it really is very difficult.
It's very frustrating for the U.S. Very frustrating for the U.S. troops involved, and it's a major source of the morale problems in Iraq, and that's also a non-story here in the U.S. It's also never reported and hardly talked about.
Yeah, and a major source of the civilian casualties, you know, where they do fire back, often what they hit are innocent bystanders.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, with that, we are once again out of time. Talking this week again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And tell people, where can they find Eat the State?
It is a free newspaper of local and global affairs. It comes out every other week. You can find it where you find free pieces of paper lying around in bookstores and cafes and other places where you find good reading material. You can also find it on the web, all of our current issue and all of our back issues at www.eatthestate.org. Oh, and I had a quick plug also. Tariq Ali, again, is going to be – he was in town last night, or speaking last night at Keystone Church. And I have
such
trouble with that
name.
Kane. Was it Hall? Hall was last night,
I thought, and I thought Keystone is
Keystone tonight? Because he's doing
I'm not sure.
Because he...
you can find out that information by going to eatthestate.org.
The calendar said that he was at Elliott Bay tonight, which is what I want to say, 7 to 9 tonight at Elliott Bay.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think Keystone was last night. But in any event, he's in town. Go see him if you have a chance.
Tariq Ali.
Yeah, I had an interview with him that also ran in the current Eat the State.
It's a good interview.
Very good guy.